tonight on Arena. Angelina Jolie as Maria Callas and Nicole Kidman as Baby Girl. And we hear tunes from the Mishnock Orchestra. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. It's all happening on Arena's film reviews on this frosty Thursday in January. Chilean director Pablo Larraín brings us Maria, which sees Angelina Jolie play opera superstar Maria Callas, reflecting on her life, her loves and her extraordinary career. And from one grand dame of cinema to another, in Baby Girl, Nicole Kidman leans into her more daring side as a high-functioning CEO who has a kinky relationship with a far younger office intern. Kieran Culkin has been winning awards already for his role as the annoying cousin in Jesse Eisenberg's odd couple road movie of sorts, A Real Pain. And Denmark's entry for this year's Oscars, The Girl with the Needle, is the grim true story of an infanticide case that horrified a nation 100 years ago. Deirdre Malumbi and Declan Burke have been to the movies for us and they join me now. Let's start with Maria, the concluding part of Pablo Larraín's trilogy of tragic women of the 20th century. It follows previous films about the complex public figures Jackie Kennedy and Diana Spencer. In Maria, Angelina Jolie plays La Divina, Maria Callas, towards the end of her life, secluded in her Paris apartment with only her butler and her prescriptions to keep her company. Declan, this is a biopic, but one only of sorts. It kind of takes the facts and then adds to them and reimagines a life that we had no entry points to.
Yes, and the reimagines is the crucial word there, I think, Kay, because, as you say, Maria, the film starts in 1977, just before she dies, and then we do a kind of a flashback to the previous couple of years. She's heavily self-medicating, as you say, with pills, and she's not fully in tune with reality. At least the reality that those who love her, you know, also have. So we quickly realise that there's an interview planned with a character called Mandrax, who is played by Coley Smith McPhee. And we also quickly realise this is an imaginary scenario that Maria has concocted for herself. But what it does is it allows us to see the reality of Maria's situation now, but also allows her to wax lyrical about her greatest triumphs. And of course, Mandrax is asking all the right questions that allows Maria to present herself in the best
possible light.
Because
she has a very small life now in her Paris apartment.
She is largely confined, rattling around this beautiful Paris apartment. She has a housekeeper, Bruno, and she has her devoted butler, who is played by Pier Francesco Favino, Ferruccio. And they're trying to care for her. She resists their kind of, you know, the thing they're trying to trap her in a small life.
Well, let's hear a clip which explains that. This is Angelina Jolie as Maria and her butler Ferruccio, played by Pier Francesco Favino, and they're arguing over her care.
Medicine cabinet is unlocked. You can throw it all away.
That is not what the doctor told us we should do.
Was he even a doctor?
He's a specialist, madam.
And what does he specialize in?
Blood. And that is why he took a sample of your blood. But he said, even before the result of the test, we should get your medication under control.
It is under control. It's under my control. And doctors hate that. I need you to make me an appointment with a hairdresser that doesn't speak. And when I write my autobiography, I will title it, The Day Ferruccio Saved My Life.
And what day was that, mother?
Every day. Every single day. Do I hate you? I fall into a river, and you always fish me out.
Yes, ma'am.
Book me a table at a cafe where the waiters know who I am. I'm in the mood for adulation.
Angelina Jolie there as Maria Callas in Maria D. We're seeing a little bit of the diva there. Yes. But what kind of Maria do we get living in this, in her Paris apartment towards the end of her life?
You know, Angelina Jolie, she gives an absolutely extraordinary performance as Maria Callas. And it's interesting because obviously Maria Callas, for anyone who didn't know, was a world-renowned Greek-American opera singer. And the word that kept coming to me watching Angelina Jolie's performance as her was the Greek word pathos. It just felt so optimal to describe her performance in that it's so kind of emotional, it's moving. But there's also something kind of pathetic about her. She is so crippled by fear and anxiety. At this point in kind of her life and career, it's been 4.5 years since she has taken to the stage. And she's really kind of crippled by insecurities and the idea of going to the stage. So she kind of puts on a bit of a show. She puts on, you know, a bit of bravado for the sake of, you know, like we were saying, her butler, her maid. But she obviously does have all of these anxieties and insecurities, and they come out in the things that she imagined and that she's kind of bigging herself up. You know, she's being interviewed by this young journalist played by Kobe Smit-McPhee, as we mentioned, who's absolutely enthralled by absolutely everything she does. So it's a very, very complex character and a complex woman. I think that Pablo Larraín does those amazing kind of portrayals of these influential 20th century, you know, world renowned, iconic women who are at these really kind of difficult, challenging points in their life, who are going through this suffering and emotional turbulence. But at the same time, he gives kind of weight and credence to the hardship that they're going through while also emphasizing hope, while also emphasizing the remarkable resilience of these women. And I think, you know, he's proven an extraordinary director in that regard. And this proves, I suppose, the final conclusion of this really epic trilogy.
Declan, you can't talk about Maria Callas without talking about music and her voice. And obviously, Angelina Jolie is not an opera singer. So how do they deal with the music? And does Pablo Larraín find an effective way of bringing that past life as the diva to us?
Yeah, I mean, look, we could give over the whole show to clips of Maria Callas. Okay, there's a brilliant conceit being used here. At one point, very early in the film, we have Maria singing to her housekeeper in the kitchen, and the housekeeper kind of looking at her in horror as she hears this kind of croaky, it's not quite as bad as I singing in the shower, for example, but it's certainly not what we're led to expect. And then we transition in the sound production to what Maria can hear, and she hears herself in her pomp. It's kind of a flashback, beautiful, lavish setting and so forth. And we hear that wonderful crystal purity, that majestic sound.
We hear and we see Angelina Jolie singing Maria Callas.
Lip-syncing to Maria Callas, and it's brilliantly done. But it's incredibly pathos is the word that Dee has used. It's the contrast is harsh because Maria is... She's got a vivid imagination. She's living this life of self, but she can't deceive her own ear. And she talks about the pain, the physical pain of singing and the agony of not being able to sing. It's absolutely heartbreaking to see and to listen to.
So I think you both enjoyed Maria very much. For stars from you, Dee, did you think that both Angelina Jolie did a great job on it and that it's worth seeing?
Absolutely, yes to both. I think that there's excellent dialogue as well. We have to give credit here to Stephen Knight, wrote the screenplay. He's best known as the writer of Peaky Blinder. He gives some epic lines in this, such as, "I don't have to perform because everyone else is performing," which Maria says at one point. But yeah, extraordinary lead performance. And it's just a very, very moving picture.
Stars out of five for me.
4 out of 5 for me.
And from you, Declan.
Yeah, I think Angelina Jolie is perfectly cast, aloof, austere, elegantly brittle, and I think the film is sumptuous. So 4 stars for me too.
Right, so that puts it up to Nicole Kidman in our next film. That's in Helena Ryan's new film, Baby Girl. Nicole Kidman plays Romy Mattis, the CEO of a successful logistics company who is sexually unsatisfied despite being married to a husband played by Antonia Banderas. Romy embarks on an affair with Samuel, played by Harris Dickinson, a far younger intern at the company who is happy to satisfy Romy's desires to be dominated. So, Dee, we know Nicole Kidman, you know, has quite, you know, she plays those little brittle wives in a lot of the TV shows. But we do know her from films like The Paperboy and Eyes Wide Shut, that she has this wilder side, looking for new and interesting material. Is that what we find her doing here?
Yeah, probably a performance like Eyes Wide Shut is what was kind of coming to mind watching this film. But yeah, Nicole Kidman is an actress who can just turn over such a range of remarkable performances. And she's absolutely exquisite here as well, even though I would say she's playing a character that you don't ever fully kind of understand. But I think that Nicole Kidman almost utilizes that in the script to make you very intrigued by her and very drawn to her. She's quite an enigmatic character. She kind of dresses in like absolutely beautifully. Her character has her hair and her makeup always put together really well. And I suppose the whole idea, at least from my reading of it, was that her outward appearance is kind of hiding this degrading lust that she feels within, because she does feel very ashamed and repressed by all of these desires within, and yet she can't kind of hold them down, as we see in this feature.
Yeah, we have a clip from, I think this is early on in the film, where Nicole Kidman's roomie has reluctantly agreed to be Samuel's mentor, played by Harris Dickinson. And this scene is their first formal mentorship conversation, and you see some of the little glitches.
You have 7 minutes.
10, I think. Thanks for making the time.
I was forced.
What?
What?
I didn't say anything. Why did you want to meet here?
You don't like this room?
No. I like the room. It's a nice room. It's very... got a nice vibe. I think it's... that's soundproof, which is good.
If I were you, I'd hurry up.
Yeah, of course, sorry. How did it start?
What?
The warehouse automation dream.
That is your question?
Yeah.
Google it.
No, I just wanted to hear from you.
Why?
Because the internet's not reliable.
I wanted to automate repetitive tasks and give people their time back by limiting...
power-hungry personalities?
You think that's what I am?
No. I think the opposite.
You think I don't like power?
No, I think you like to be told what to do. Sorry, I didn't mean to... Sorry, that was inappropriate.
I think he did mean it. That's Harris Dickinson playing Samuel there. So already the games are beginning between them, even at this first formal meeting, Declan. So how does it develop? Is it about power? Is it about sex? Is it about power within a sexual relationship?
Well, we are told on a number of occasions that it is exactly about power. And that clip, that kernel where he says is about the you want your power taken away effectively is what he's saying, which is a bit of a daring gambit in an initial interview with your boss. And at the time didn't quite ring true for me, even though I was aware of the context of the film. So there are a lot of buttons being pushed in this film. So Romy is acutely aware that Samuel's half her age. He's an employee in our company. There is the potential for abuse of her abusing her power by having an affair with him. This is all setting aside the ethics of her, the fact that she's married and has two kids and so forth. But when Samuel suggests a relationship on the basis of giving and taking of power, everybody's sitting back in the seats, oh, that sounds very sensible. That's all very 21st century, Kay. You know, we're all on board with that. Except as it proceeds, it's all about Samuel taking her power away. Doesn't, you know, it's a one-way street. And I know,
and that would involve like humiliation and degrading behaviour.
Yes, there's a domination effect to it, and he's basically ordering her to do things that she's not comfortable with doing. Like, for example, you know, he forces her to, or instructs her to go on her hands and knees and lick milk out of a saucer like a cat and so forth, which is kind of preposterous on one level. Now, it's an interesting and it's intriguing thing, because what we're doing here, what the filmmakers are doing here, they're flipping the kind of 50 Shades gender dynamic. And that is theoretically interesting because of the age difference between the two characters and so forth. But it's the one-sided nature of the quote-unquote giving and taking of power that left me feeling a bit cheated in terms of the central theme of the film.
Cheated or uncomfortable, Dee?
Probably more so uncomfortable, at least for me. I was watching this thinking, oh my goodness, I'm not going to see this movie with my parents. But yeah, that idea of the notion of power, it is an interesting one. There is a bit of a push-pull there, and it's not a typical submissive dominant relationship as we would have seen in, yeah, exactly, something like 50 Shades of Grey, like, because you have Romy who's going kind of back and forth on the relationship. Samuel is actually the one that brings up the conversation of consent, which is quite interesting, and even though Romy has, you know, age and experience on him, it's Samuel who actually lays down boundaries upon being mistreated by her. Even, I suppose, the idea of power is incorporated into the chosen settings of their affair. They go to a dirty hotel room at one point and then at another very classy hotel room, even like an overpacked nightclub, which again was kind of, I suppose, pushing the boundaries of realism, because I couldn't imagine the character of Romy, who's been so careful with her affair thus far, go to a setting like that to kind of conduct her relationship with Samuel. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I also kind of appreciate
it. Is it daring? I mean, is it pushing boundaries there? Did you feel either shocked or interested by the dilemma?
I'm probably uncomfortable would be the dominant word when it comes to, feel pardon the pun using the word dominant there. But yeah, probably uncomfortable was kind of the main sensation I saw seeing it. But at the same time, I could appreciate that, you know, this film reminded me of something like, you know, The Piano Teacher years and years ago, in that is it kind of interesting in a way that it's kind of redefining what female desire is and what a woman can necessarily want, which isn't kind of the typical thing in the bedroom. And her husband have a few conversations with, and she's so stifled by the idea of like communicating exactly what it is she wants, because it is taboo and it isn't kind of the quote unquote normal thing. So I thought the film was interesting in that way, and there were other kind of conversations and I suppose contemporary themes it was like touching on, like the idea of, you know, business and infidelity and sex and relationships and how they've kind of changed between the past and the present. But at the same time, I did feel like some of those themes were maybe a little underdeveloped.
So overall, Declan, what did you think and what stars would you give it?
I thought it was well cast. I thought the two individual performances were very good. I didn't think there was a great deal of chemistry, and largely because a lot of what Dee is saying, and I agree completely with what she's saying, didn't feel organic to the characters. It felt like, you know, what kind of issues do we need to deal with in this film? And that's not a good way to proceed. It doesn't really deliver on its daring promise, as you suggest. 3 stars from me.
Okay, and from you, Dee?
Yeah, I'd probably give this film 3.5 stars. Like, it was entertaining. I think, to be honest, most of those 3.5 stars are down to Nicole Kidman, who turns in another absolutely exquisite performance here. But yeah, a bit of a mixed film for me, I'd say.
All right. So in A Real Pain, American cousins David and Benji embark on a family pilgrimage to Poland, travelling to the village that their beloved late grandmother was born. The film was written and directed by Jesse Eisenberg, who plays David, and Kieran Culkin as Benji is garnering a lot of awards buzz, with the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor already in his back pocket as of Sunday night last. So Declan, the dynamic here is two cousins who were very close, who have grown apart and are going on this pilgrimage to Poland.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about, you know, the nature of their relationship in the early stages. It's a kind of an odd couple shtick. To start, we see David, who's played by Jesse Eisenberg. He's in a taxi. He's stressed. He's anxious. He's ringing Benji. Are you at the airport? The traffic. I'm stuck. He's ringing him back. The traffic is eased up. So we know that David is a bit uptight and he's a bit buttoned up and so forth. Meanwhile, Benji has been at the airport for about 2 hours because he likes to hang out at airports and watch all the odd people walking. So we know there's two very different kind of personalities coming together here. But gradually, the idea of, you know, this quote unquote two Jews traveling in Poland, as they describe themselves, it does give way to deeper resonances. And it becomes clear that there are serious mental health issues at play here. David suffers from OCD and Benji seems to be living with manic depression. His mood swings are quite severe. He's deeply sensitive to emotional stimuli. And that in turn, as the film proceeds, we realise is a consequence of living in the long shadow of the Holocaust.
Now, as we said, Kieran Culkin gives a tour de force here as Benji, the wayward cousin. And we'll play a clip here from when they're on a train and they're on their way to Poland, and they're in the first class carriage, and Benji has a meltdown.
Still
Yo, dude, I think we should move.
What?
I think you should move to another train car.
What do you mean?
You don't feel weird being in a first-class car?
No, we paid for it. It's not hurting anybody. No.
Dude, we are Jews on a train in Poland. Fucking think about it.
Benji? Benji?
Yeah.
You're all right up there.
Yeah, sure. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, you know, it's, to be fair, fascinating.
No, I mean, I just feel like, sorry.
Okay.
Is anyone else, like, feeling this right now?
Feeling what?
Like, this creepy feeling that, like, you know, we're, like, royalty on this train? I mean, does no one else see the irony here?
Jesus.
Like, eating fancy food and sitting up here when 80 years ago we would have been herded into the backs of these fucking things like cattle.
God. Okay, Benji, I don't think anybody here wants to hear that right now.
Okay, but why not? Why doesn't anyone want to hear it?
Because it's depressing.
Okay, look, depressing?
It's okay. You're raising an interesting sensitivity here. It does sometimes come up on these tours. You're staying in fancy hotels, eating posh food, and at the same time you're looking back at the horrors of your family history.
So Kieran Culkin there as Benji. And I think when Jesse Eisenberg talked to Sean during the week, he was saying that he wrote the part of Benji for himself. But somebody said, hey, you can't take on such a big role and be directing the film. Benji is quite a character. We see that explosion, but it's one of many we have, either of huge friendship towards other people in the group or just those kind of deep insights.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, actually, that Jesse Eisenberg intended to play Benji himself because he is such a David. And I couldn't help as I was watching.
That's so true.
I couldn't help as I was watching a real pain kind of thinking, this very much feels like the two actors' most renowned characters of Mark Zuckerberg and Roman Roy have almost been just dropped into the situation of a real pain. But at that, you know, those two characters that those two actors are known so well for kind of respectively playing, you know, one being kind of, in terms of the Roman Roy character, kind of saying exactly how he feels, holding nothing back, being full of expletives versus, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, i.e., you know, the kind of characters this Jesse Eisenberg usually plays, who are like, you know, socially awkward and neurotic and stuff like that. It absolutely does work, you know, those two characters placed in this context. And Culkin, in terms of like winning the Best Supporting Actor Golden Globe for his performance here, it's absolutely deserved. He is so, so funny in this movie, and yet he gives a very kind of emotional, emotive performance as well. You can see how when he's going around, he just he establishes the group dynamic in that he's always like looking out for everyone, making sure no one feels excluded, looking out particularly for the character of Marcia, who's played by a Dirty Dancing icon Jennifer Grey, actually. He buys the group all like water, make sure they stay hydrated, you know, gets them all to pose for a picture. Meanwhile, you know, David is very awkwardly kind of taking pictures on all of their camera phones because he doesn't want to like get into the photo because it's inappropriate. So yeah, that kind of odd couple dynamic really, really works. So it's so interesting to imagine that, Jesse Eisenberg could have played, you know, Benji at some point because he's so well suited to David here. But a lot of credit as well has to be given to Jesse Eisenberg's direction and his script here. He's really proven himself a triple threat with The Real Pain.
Yeah, the script is a great script.
Yeah, it kind of lures us in initially with this kind of breezy black comedy, and even though those some of the lines that the Benji character throws out in the clip that you played there, you know, he's making a very serious point, but in the context it's hard not to laugh at how kind of preposterous he sees. That's a relatively early stage. As the film progresses and we get to visit the ghetto in Warsaw side of the Jewish uprising, and we also get a tour of, or they get a tour of, one of the death camps, the mood does gradually, but it's beautifully modulated by Jesse Eisenberg. And I have to say, as a director, he's also incredibly generous to the character of Benji. He does step back and see, I mean, maybe see it so early on, Kieran Culkin is knocking it out of the park. He steps back, gives him all the space and room he needs, and it's a direction is fine, is terrific, I should say. But that generosity, you don't often get that from a relatively new director.
Indeed. Stars out of five from you, Declan, for A Real Pain.
Yeah, it's 4 stars from me.
And for you, Dee?
Yeah, 4 stars. It's both very entertaining, but also has a huge amount of depth. Really, really impressive movie.
Now, finally this evening, to the Danish chiller, The Girl with the Needle, which is especially grim to realise it's based on a true story. Declan, this is Denmark's entry into this year's Oscars, and it is, it's set like shortly after the First World War, the events happened.
Yeah, I think the war is just about to come to an end. We're in Copenhagen, Kay, and you say it's great. I actually, half an hour in, I was thinking, I really hope this is based on a true story, because if somebody actually sat down to make this up, that's just an incredibly perverse prospect. The main character is Caroline. We first meet her when she's been evicted from her flat. She's a factory worker. She works in a textiles factory. And she's been evicted from quite a squalid flat. And you're thinking, that's not the worst thing that could happen, except then we see the new flat, which is even worse. Her husband is at the front. Peter's been missing in action for a year. She has fallen in love with the factory owner. She gets pregnant. He's delighted. His mother puts the, you know, pulls the plug on the relationship. Then Peter comes back from the front. He's horribly disfigured. This is all the first 20 minutes, Kay. I'm not giving away too many spoilers. And it's all in absolutely delicious, but utterly bleak black and white. So yes, grim is the word you used, and grim is where we're at.
Yes, because we're not even at the crime yet in what Declan has described.
Yeah, so what essentially happens next, and again, this isn't spoilers, this really is just in the first few minutes of the movie, and yes, it does get even bleaker. But Caroline comes to, in these absolutely desperate circumstances, befriends a woman named Dagmar, and the two end up kind of working together. And Dagmar kind of runs a sweet shop front, but her real business is basically running this underground illegal adoption agency that buys unwanted babies, and, you know, inevitably she takes in Caroline's baby as well. Well, and gives them to families, for example, doctors and lawyers who cannot have children of their own. But as it turns out, there is another, you know, nature to this business.
All right. OK, The Girl with the Needle, stars out of 5 from UD.
You know, this movie is absolutely impossible to recommend. It is so cruel. It's so grim. It's so bleak. It's a really difficult one to recommend, even though the acting is fantastic and the cinematography, as bleak as it is, can be really beautiful. But it's a really upsetting and unsettling movie. So 2 stars from me.
From you, Declan.
I was superb performances, and it's beautifully made, Kay. It really is, but it is relentlessly grim. I'm giving it 4 stars because it's a terrifically well made film.
If you find yourself in the cinema. But there are so many wonderful films to see. You can or need not go to see it. Declan Burke and Deirdre Malumbi, thank you so much. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. This Saturday, the Mishnock Orchestra takes to the stage at the National Concert Hall to launch their self-titled debut album, a unique blend of Irish traditional music and classical styles. At the centre of it is Ciarán Fitzgerald, a composer, conductor and pharmacist from Kildare, whose Mishnock Suite brings together over 50 musicians from across the country. The album, recorded at Windmill Lane Studios, showcases the orchestra's sound, a fresh take on Irish music that blends tradition with creativity. And I'm delighted to welcome Ciarán to the studio to tell us more about it. So tell me first about the origins of the orchestra. How did you get this 50 or so musicians together?
Yeah, so the orchestra came out of a project around COVID times. So to commemorate 40 years of our local Coltis branch, CCE Leixlip, or Craiv Vartla I Láthairte, I was asked to write a piece of music. And when I was sitting down thinking, what'll I do? I suppose what came out of COVID was a big fragmentation of the musicians. We hadn't seen each other. We hadn't played together in ages. So what we aimed to create was a project that brought people together, brought the musicians from the branch back together. And we reached out to friends of the branch, friends of friends, and we formed an orchestra. And it kicked off with the first concert in 2023, and it's gone from strength to strength ever since. We've travelled around the country playing, and there's been a huge response to it, and we're so happy now with an album and playing in the concert hall.
And did you compose a lot before you started composing for the orchestra?
So I'd done a little bit of composition my whole life, just ever since I was a kid. I always had music going around my head, and I'd write it down the odd time, but I'd never composed in such a structured way and for an orchestra before. So when I did get the opportunity to do it, I really wanted to give it my all and to try it out. And I reached out to some friends. I'd had experience playing in orchestras before, so I drew on all of that. And yeah, it's turned out very nice.
So when you say it's an orchestra and it's made up of traditional musicians, what kind of instruments do we have?
So we have a lot of the typical traditional music instruments. We have accordions, banjos, concertinas, flutes, fiddles or violins, depending on who you ask, flutes, did I mention flutes? And then we have...
So you've wind and strings and
wind
percussion.
And strings, percussion. We have the bowron, we have keyboard, guitar, and we have all the strings then. So we have violins, violas, cellos, double basses. So we have a huge range of instruments playing.
Now, there are many, many traditional musicians who can read music, but there are many who do it by ear. It's kind of the traditional way of learning traditional tunes. So what did you find amongst your orchestra? Had they to be able to read music?
So, yeah, it's a very interesting one. We had a range of people, so people with traditional backgrounds, people with classical backgrounds, some who were very accustomed to reading music, some who weren't. And I suppose this trad orchestra, the advent of the trad orchestra, has combined this organization and more of a freedom of expression. And we have met somewhere in the middle where our traditional musicians are learning to read music and are learning. Now, a lot of them do actually. I give them the music and they turn up to the practices and there's no music in front of them. They've learnt it off by heart at home because that's what they're comfortable with. And you'll see at the concert the next day, some will have maybe almost a cheat sheet, or some will have nothing at all in front of them because they've learned the whole suite off by heart. And then some musicians are much more accustomed to playing with music and they'll play. But we have all sorts going on. We have somewhere in the middle between traditional and classical.
And is that challenging then for the conductor when somebody has learned it off by heart, you're saying?
No, do you know what? It's great. We have a certain level of freedom, and I think no two times that we play a piece does it sound exactly the same. But I think that's part of the charm of it. It's organized music, but at the same time, that bit of freedom that comes with playing traditional music and what we've all grown up with.
Now, the album is called the Mishnok Orchestra, as well as your orchestra being called Mishnok, which of course means courage. But we'd like to go and play some of the tracks. Maybe you talk us into The Lass of Glenshee.
Yes, so this is a piece that actually I'd heard originally from a great friend of mine called Jack Warnock. So he's the guitarist with the orchestra and he's actually mixed the album for us now. He's a great friend, a great musical inspiration, and we're so lucky to work with him. And on his recent album, Le Solus Vihine, he performed this ballad and we have put our own spin on it now. And the arrangement features interplay between the reeds and the strings, and it kind of represents the conversation that's going on between the protagonist, the man who's trying to win the heart of a woman.
Okay, let's listen to some of that. This is The Lass of Glenshee.
Phoebus had risen, shone over the lea. I spied a young maiden down by the river, herding her flocks on the hills of Glenshee. I stood in amazement, said I, pretty fair maid, if you will come down to Jamestown with me. Oh, there's ne'er been a lady set foot in my castle, there's never been a lady quite grander than thee.
wonderful foregrounding of the banjo there, as well as Jack Warnock's wonderful voice.
Yes, absolutely. The banjos there, we've a wonderful banjo section, but we try to feature every section and, you know, give them all the expression to play and be main parts of different different pieces of music. So you'll hear throughout the suite the banjo featured, the viola featured, the cello featured. We try to give everyone the space, you know, to explore the music.
What do they think of the name Mishnock? Do they think, yeah, we need courage and we have courage and we're going to do it?
I think absolutely. I think it's something that everyone's gotten on board with. It comes from the crest of Kildare. So The orchestra would very much be rooted in Kildare, and the words on the crest of Kildare is Manma agus Mishnach, which means spirit and courage. And we have a piece of music as well called Manma, and the title piece and the first piece of every show is called Mishnach. So I think everyone's bought into the spirit and courage aspect of the orchestra.
Now, when you said, you know, when you were asked to compose and then you started looking around your home place to get inspiration, you looked to the rivers and you looked to the waterways, and we're going to play some of the Yellow Spectres now, but that's a really poignant, dramatic story.
Yeah, so I suppose this is a slow air, and it combines the concertina played by Gerard Keane and the string section. The concertina and the fiddle is a very classic combo within the world of traditional music. You have the likes of Tony Lennon and Noel Hill, or MacDaren Micheál O'Reilly, and the marriage of reeds and strings, it works really, really well, and we tried to explore it in a brand new way. So when I wrote this slow air, I wrote it for the concertina, and I wanted to really try and tell the story of this, the forced pilgrimage and the forced emigration of the 1,490 tenants who walked along the banks of the Royal Canal from Strokestown to County Roscommon up to Dublin. It's the national
famine. This is during famine times, and they're walking to try and get on, well, what was going to be a coffin ship.
Yeah, exactly. So it was forced emigration to Quebec, and it's now known as the National Famine Way. It's 165 kilometres. And of those 1,490 people who were forced out, fewer than half of them survived the trip, and those that came ashore in Quebec were said to have come ashore looking like yellow spectres. So that's where the name comes from.
So let's listen to Yellow Spectres now. That's a part of the Yellow Spectre there from the Mishnock Orchestra. So you recorded the album in Windmill Lane, where the Mishnock Orchestra used to be recorded. What kind of a feat was that to undertake?
No, it was a totally new experience for nearly all of us. The first time, that we'd been together as an orchestra in a studio for sure. And it was an amazing experience. I mean, what a studio to do it in, Windmill Lane. And we thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, I suppose because the orchestra are all volunteers, we all have jobs, we all have studies, we could only do it over a limited amount of time. So we had 2 days in the studio, but I mean, what we produced was fabulous, and it's just a testament to the musicians and their ability, but also the guys in the studio. They were really, really a joy to work with, and we enjoyed it.
And were they recorded as the ensemble they are, or were they recorded in parts?
All together, yeah. So we were all together in one big room. We had lots of baffles up to try and isolate the instruments so that everyone could be heard. And it took a little bit of creative planning, but we managed to get everyone in the one room. Yeah.
Now, the album launch is the big event. Well, what can people expect to hear? The whole orchestra will be there. You'll be conducting.
Yes. So it's going to be a fabulous night, and it's really going to represent the music of Kildare and the flourishing tradition within the county. So the night will be kicked off by two fabulous guest acts. So we have Alta first up. They are the winners of Sheehan Sagailin 2024, representing Kildare. Next up is the 2024 All-Ireland Senior Cailí Band Champions, the Bartlett O'Flaherty Cailí Band. And then the orchestra will perform the Mishnach Suite in the second half. So you will get to hear the entire suite of music performed live with dancers, singers. It will be a lovely evening of music in the National Concert Hall. And what better stage to do it on?
What better stage? And Ciarán, it sounds like a wonderful night. Ciarán Fitzgerald, thank you so much. Composer and conductor with the Mishnach Orchestra, who will launch their debut album with a concert at the National Concert Hall on January the 11th. More details on nch.ie. And another orchestra evening for you now, also at the NCH, coming up later this month. The RT Concert Orchestra has lined up a gorgeous evening of famous romantic classics featuring Brahms' First Violin Concerto and Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, The Pathétique. Two exciting female artists join the orchestra for the first time, Austrian-Spanish conductor Teresa Rivera-Baum and Dutch star violinist Roseanne Philippens. And I'm delighted the Roseanne Philippens joins us now from Amsterdam. Roseanne, you're very welcome, and we're looking forward to you coming to Dublin.
Thank you so much.
Now, this is a concert of romantic classical music. Tell us a little bit about that era and what was it that the romantic composers were striving to achieve?
Well, I think it was all about expressing oneself, or just display a lot of emotions and feelings. And this evening that we are going to create together is really about that. Tchaikovsky is a gigantic famous piece, and Bruch is as famous, I would say. He wrote three violin concertos, actually, Max Bruch. But this first one is actually the only one that is that famous. The other two, I don't think they are really played a lot. So, but yes.
Yes, I was reading somewhere that Bruch was a bit annoyed that people loved this concerto so much that they kind of didn't bother with and sufficiently with his other compositions because they loved performing it.
Well, yes, it was his most famous piece. He also wrote this beautiful piece, A Scottish Fantasy. This is also for violin and orchestra. But I think the first violin concerto has always been his most famous piece. Yes.
Yeah, because you're talking about romantic composers there and what they were looking for. They were looking to bring emotion into their work. And there's a lot of emotion in this Max Bruch's violin concerto, isn't there?
Yes, it has this beautiful opening where the orchestra starts for a few bars, and then the violin plays a small, you could say a small cadenza, and there's already so much, you could say, pathétique in that. The name is actually Vorspiel, so you could say introduction. And then the first movement takes off, and it's full of energy and rhythm. But then the second movement is this lyrical, beautiful piece. I think everybody will dream away when listening to it. So yes, it's a lot of emotions. Yes, you could say that. Yes.
Yes. Well, let's listen to some of Max Bruch's Violin Concerto Number 1 in G minor.
Thank you.
There we heard from the first movement of Max Bruch's Violin Concerto No. 1 in G minor, Opus 26. There, Roseanne, that was Janine Jansen there performing. You're going to be performing, you will be playing the violin, and then Teresa Rivero Baum is going to be your conductor. Have you worked with her before? Are you aware of her work?
Yes, yes, we have worked before together, which was really a big pleasure. We played with a BBC Scottish symphony. We played Prokofiev, and yes, she was so energetic and also sweet, which is also very nice to have someone sweet collaborating with you. But mostly just very, very energetic and serious and focused. So I'm very much looking forward to work with her again.
Now, do you have conversations, like phone conversations, before a concert like this? Or do you just wait to get together?
Well, I'm traveling mostly to my concerts, and then I arrive, and then we always have a conversation with the conductor before. If you're lucky, if there's time, you meet the conductor, for example, in the hotel lobby, and you just discuss the piece, or the next day before the rehearsal, that's also possible that you meet in the dressing room or something. Yes. So you always see each other before, yes.
What is that piece like to play? I mean, it's full. We can hear that wonderful emotion and in the piece. What is it like to play?
I think it's one of the first concertos that you learn, at least. It was one of the first concertos that I learned. So I played it already when I was quite young. So it's a bit misleading, because you would think that it's not so difficult, but then when you play it in action with the orchestra, suddenly you have to be very rhythmical and very precise, and then it suddenly becomes this extra difficult piece. But because it really takes you away, it really guides you in emotions, so you can just go with the flow. So it has all these elements, but it's mostly just wonderful to play, because it's quite compact. It's not so long, and the movements are very clear. The second movement is really a beautiful slow movement, and so it's a nice compact piece. And the last movement is very festive. So you can end with a little party, let's say.
Oh, lovely, a little party to end it. I know that the concert orchestra are very excited to have you and Teresa to work with on this. Is it the same for the soloist going to work with the new orchestra?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Is it exciting for a soloist to go working with a new orchestra?
Yes, it's wonderful. I love it. It's always a bit, in a nice way, a bit scary to meet an orchestra for the first time, because, they work with so many soloists. You really have to prove yourself. But I like that kind of pressure, actually. So with the first rehearsal, you come on the stage. It's very silent. The conductor introduces you. And then the only thing you can do is just try to play as beautiful as possible and try to make this connection from the start. I mean, normally you meet a person, you start talking, you look each other in the eyes, but with this, in this situation, you just have to show yourself with playing, with your craftsmanship. So it's a particular situation. It's always difficult to explain to other people how that feels.
Yeah, but it does, you know. It's not only the performance for the audience, but there is that initial kind of meeting and playing with an orchestra for the first time. So there's almost two fences to jump with each performance.
Yes, yes. And they're very different from each other. That's also funny. The rehearsal is without audience, and you're intimate, quite intimate on stage with the orchestra. And then the concert, well, I also turn around many times in the rehearsal. So I stand with my face towards the orchestra, while at the concert, I'm with my back to the orchestra and I face the audience. So it's already a bit different. But it's great because you get to know the orchestra, and the next day you turn around and you show what the interpretation that you created together to the audience.
Yeah, well, that's a really nice way of getting to know them. Rosanna, we're dying to have you here in Dublin. Thank you so much for talking to us. Rosanne Philippins, she appears with the RT Concert Orchestra at the National Concert Hall on the 25th of January in the event Tchaikovsky and Bruck. Further details from RT.ie/CO. That's it for tonight's programme. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Harry Bucklus is on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and the show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.